Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Tuesday, May 9th, Carver Board of Aldermen work session on the budget and other matters. Before we get started, Jackie.
Before we get started, in my 17 years of public service, I've only made one mistake. You know, I only made one mistake, and that was nominating Joel. No, you asked for that. And last week I made a big one. I made a motion that I was trying to pull things together, was trying to pass a motion that we were crafting on the charter amendment, and at the same time answer people's need to talk about it more, and instead came up with something completely empty. It was my only mistake, and it will be the only one that I make in the future. But I want to go back and fix that, so I would like at this moment, and I had talks about parliamentary procedure to make sure that I get this, right now I would like to make a motion that we reconsider last week's motion on the charter amendment.
A second.
Thank you.
All right. A motion for reconsideration has been made and properly seconded. A motion for reconsideration can only be made by someone who voted in favor of the original motion, which Jackie did. Essentially, the effect of a motion for reconsideration on this matter would be, Mr. Attorney, you correct me if I'm wrong, but in effect it puts the matter, it undoes the resolution that we passed before endorsing the charter amendment and puts the matter back up for discussion.
Yes, I guess that's technically correct, although to be super technical, it probably needs to be, a motion needs to be made in the meeting in which it takes place, but frankly, it really doesn't make much difference. I mean, as a procedural matter, I understand we had instructions to send something which I have not yet sent, so if the motion because I understood this was coming, so if the motion is just to not send the charter amendment or to do something else with it, I don't think we need to get more technical than that. Just make that motion to do what you want to do.
Okay, then I would like to add to my motion that we not send the charter amendment to our legislative delegation at this time and that in the fall when we're past the budget and we have time to think this out with a more thorough discussion, that we then revisit the charter discussion, but for the moment, we're not sending anything to the delegation. Is that?
Yes, I still second.
Okay. All right. So it's been moved and properly seconded that we essentially unendorse that charter, particular charter amendment. All those in favor signify. If you have some discussion, yes.
What's the rationale behind it? Are we?
Because the motion I made was really dumb. What I said was that we were going to ask for a charter amendment, and by doing that, pass it on to our legislative delegation, who would, if they chose to follow, you know, if they chose to act on it, would kind of go through a big deal over in Raleigh. And then the motion also said that we were going to reconsider it in August. So to have them go through a charter amendment on something that we were going to reconsider in August just really didn't make a lot of sense.
I understand that part. What I don't understand is what is it to reconsider in others that we did not.
Well, because
fix
I think
time.
A lot. Well, because what we fixed this time was just kind of to clear it up, and I think that there are some people who still have some ideas and who would still like to kind of address the meat of the issue more thoroughly, and we don't have time this evening to do that. So I just wanna get it off the table for now and have it very clear that, and not put our legislators through hoop jumping, and make it very clear that we will come back. You know, there's not an election for another 18 months. We have time to deal with this.
Let me add, John, the reason I supported this is that I agree with the point that something that only passes 4-3 on our board, if there's any question about it, it comes up in the legislature, it's going to be in a weak position. And that I think we can get to the point where, you know, we may not come up with something we'll be unanimous on, but I believe we can probably do better than 4-3 in some future consideration. You know, I in no way disagree with the, I'm not disagreeing with the vote I made last week in terms of, in principle, but in terms of the pragmatic point that Jackie's raising, I think makes sense.
Meanwhile, the statute, the charter remains the way it is then.
Yeah, but we don't have another election
until
for a year and a half.
Do anything else.
Until we fix it.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It would leave the system the way it is for now. And in fact,
it
the change doesn't actually make any substantive difference. So either way.
But it gives us a good opportunity to take a look at it carefully rather than rushing to judgment.
I think, you know, my sense of it is that our delegation that represents Carrboro may view this issue, the three members of the House may view this issue a little bit differently, and for us to be so closely divided in what we recommended to them is sort of asking for a tempest in a teapot over something that may not be that important, and that it would be better for us to go back in the 2007 legislative session with a plan that at least six, maybe seven of us can get behind. So it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed.
There you go, Mr. Manager, Mr. Attorney.
All right, well, that part
feel
we
better.
Can at least.
that part.
Right.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, ma'am.
Are we still meeting with them on Friday?
Yes, we are. Yes,
okay,
we are, because we have a whole different legislative agenda to address. And briefly on that point, I know it's not on our printed agenda, but does everybody on this board feel that we know enough about the Land for Tomorrow initiative, the state, that basically where we would be urging, the proposal is for us to endorse it, and that we would be
mm-hmm.
endorsing adding, buying $200 million worth of open space, having the state buy $200 million worth of open space over the next 5 years. And I guess my question is just, do we know enough about that? Are we ready to, can we just quickly add that to our legislative agenda?
Well, I just have one question. If you could just, I'll vote for it if you send me information about how they're going to allocate what lands they purchase. Because, you know, I have a sort of view of a lot of the land that's purchased for open space is never in neighborhoods that really need open space.
Hmm.
So I want to know what the criteria is, because there are some places in the inner city where they could buy open space, but they choose not to, saying, well, we want to develop that and not provide mm-hmm. open space. So if there's some sort of nice criteria that not, you know, it's my $200 million and it's poor people's $200 million, and they should be able to have the benefits of that open space as well. But I'll support it. I'll move it.
That's
but,
an excellent point.
But I do want an email about that.
I think the email John sent us had a link with those
right.
details.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we should make a point in endorsing this plan of just mentioning that aspect of, you know, that we would hope that our legislative delegation would advocate for this and advocate for it in that context.
And also the I'm an ambassador, actually, of this project, and it's basically, I mean, we're betting here on the future. And those exact questions will be debated and asked by all our legislature and the Senate and the House. And also you folks for the retreat, I believe, or I request that everybody has to have that thick booklet of the whole concept. I mean, this is a concept and it has to be debated. I mean, and the law has to be passed. And believe me, and this is, that question is something the legislature, our delegation should. We should make sure they ask, as we support the concept, you know, which is great, but the criteria and all that stuff, believe me, and I think with the new auditor we have in the state, all these projects will be under a lot of scrutiny, and we need to make sure that, the right criteria that we support be included in the legislation that hasn't passed, I mean, that might pass. We'd love to move to we adopt this resolution.
Okay. And I want to say a special thank you to you, John, for bringing this whole issue to the board's attention and also for playing a role statewide in helping to promote the Land for Tomorrow initiative. So it's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we pass this resolution endorsing the North Carolina Land for Tomorrow initiative, and I think with the understanding that we would like our state legislative delegation to ensure that this will be that the space will be in urban areas as well as rural areas and areas of all different income levels. So it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. We'll add that to the list of subjects we're going to discuss with our legislative delegation. Yes, and we'll, Madam Clerk, if we could send a copy of that to the North Carolina Land for Tomorrow Coalition so that they will have a record of us supporting it. And then two other things, very, very briefly. I issued a proclamation this past week, or earlier this week, proclaiming that that this week be designated National Tourism Week, and I want to read briefly a part of it. It says, whereas the travel and tourism industry supports the vital interests of Carrboro and Orange County, contributing to our employment, economic prosperity, understanding, and goodwill, and whereas the people throughout the town, state, and country and world become more aware of the outstanding cultural, historical, and recreational resources available in Carrboro and Orange County, and whereas given the travel and tourism industry is vital to our economic stability and growth and contributes substantially to Carrboro and Orange County's cultural and social well-being, it is fitting that we recognize the efforts of the Chapel Hill Orange County Visitors Bureau and the importance of travel and tourism. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, the mayor of the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, in recognition of the unique significance of the travel and tourism industry in the lives of Carrboro residents, do hereby proclaim the week of May 13th through 21st, 2006, as National Tourism Week in the town of Carrboro, and recognize that tourism works in our town. This is the 19th day of April, 2006.
Can I ask a question that brings to mind? I'm wondering if anyone is planning on going to that Visitors Bureau breakfast. I think it's on the 23rd.
I will be diligently representing you there. Looking forward to it. And the other thing is, I think this was briefly mentioned the other day at our Board of Aldermen meeting, but I don't know if any of y'all have driven recently down High Street in Carrboro, but I think one thing that many of us have heard over the years is about dangerous traffic conditions on High Street as well as a number of other streets in Carrboro, and you all recall that last year we adopted a new we finalized a way of prioritizing where we were going to implement traffic calming procedures, mm-hmm. and that process has really worked well, and it has culminated in a new set of speed tables, as they're called, speed bumps, as the rest of us would call them, on High Street. And I think it has turned out to be really both really effective and really efficiently done. The Public Works Department, I understand, did all of the work in-house at a very cost-effective way, and I just thought that we ought to recognize our entire town staff for coming together to make that happen in a really cost-effective manner. Thanks for doing that. With why not?
Briefly, I just want to, otherwise we especially for the folks who are paying attention on TV today, how are we going to spend their tax dollars? The Chapel Hill Carrboro NAACP is sponsoring a Freedom Fund banquet on Saturday, May 20th of 2006 at the Hargrove Recreational Center at 7 p.m. And the purpose of this event is to raise funds for the scholarships and to increase awareness to eliminate the conduct of discrimination and injustice against minority people. We're making a special effort to support deserving hardworking students who have distinguished themselves in IB and academics, and whose access to financial support might be limited. And I would like to invite everyone to support this great effort and to contact Fred Battle, president of the NAACP, to support the students in our community who will be benefiting from this program.
Okay. thanks for bringing that up. And I'm sorry for so much of this, but I forgot to, I also promised the folks from the Orange County Library System that I would point out that a week from tomorrow, May 20th, is going to be Check Out Your Library Day. And all residents of our community are encouraged to stop by and visit one of the Orange County branch libraries, the Carbo Branch Library, which is in McDougal Middle School Media Center, or the Cybrary, or the Chapel Hill Town Library, or the other two branches. There'll be special events that day. It'll be a great time to visit and learn more.
Is that a week from tomorrow, which is the 17th, or is it the 20th, which is a week from Saturday?
It is the 20th, which is a week from Saturday. Okay. Sorry. Thanks. Okay. So now on to our printed agenda at last. Mr. Manager.
Okay. This is a budget work session tonight. We have three planned presentations for you all. And the first one is our performance benchmarking project. We have Bill Rivenbach, who is a professor with the UNC School of Government. And Bill, you're going to introduce Dale. Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Steve. Mayor and members of the Board of Aldermen, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk to you just briefly this evening about the North Carolina benchmarking project. You have two pieces of information in front of you. One is the final report on city services for FY0405, which is our performance and cost data report that Carborough's numbers and performance and cost data is located in. I'll take this opportunity at this point as well to introduce Dale Rennick, who worked with me at the School of Government on collecting and cleaning the 348 pages of data contained in this report. The second piece of information is just a two-page handout that I'm going to be just using for my talking points tonight. We have three goals of the project. The first is to develop and expand the use of performance measurement in local government. I think if I was talking here 10 years ago, we still may be questioning if performance measurement was a passing fad. But it is not. It is here in local government to stay on the idea that we're going to make data-driven decisions. The second goal is to produce reliable performance and cost data for comparison. The idea of performance measurement, that we're going to track our data internally over time for trend analysis. The benchmarking component is we're going to take those measures and put them into the context of other jurisdictions, that we can obtain some information from trend analysis, but we can either gather more information when we put that into a comparative format. And then the final goal of the project is the one that we are really bearing down on right now, and that is to facilitate the use of performance and cost data for service improvement. I always say it takes 6 months to collect and clean this data. It takes 6 months to use this data. It's a hard thing to do, to go in and find where the trends are and find where the opportunities are so Carborough can change its way of doing businesses to pick up those efficiencies and effectiveness. I've given you the project participants. There's currently 16 participating in the benchmarking project, and I give you the populations. Carborough is one of the smaller, or is the smallest municipality participating, but we do standardize our measure, especially the workloads you'll see per 1,000 population, for example, and we standardize those measures so you can compare yourself against a Charlotte, as opposed to if we just reported out the raw data, you would not be able to. I'd also like to just point out that as size of organization increases, as you know, that organization has more capacity. Charlotte and those others have a lot of budget analysts. Carborough does not have 10 budget analysts here in Town Hall. And I just want to thank Carborough for finding the capacity, the organizational capacity, to participate in a project like this, because to collect this information can be burdensome on staff. And we thank you for that. The service areas are currently under study. We have 10, from solid waste to public safety to asphalt, it's building inspections, fleet maintenance, human resources, and so forth. We do add a new service area from time to time. Probably once every other year we will select a new service area. Right now what we're doing is going back and auditing an existing service, and this we're doing working with fleet maintenance right now. So we're not only expanding the project from time to time, but we also like to stop and revisit the information we're currently collecting to make sure is we are as comparable as possible. Point here, we will never have a pure apples-to-apples comparison. There are always discrepancies among municipalities, but that's okay. You want to identify some of those discrepancies. Some of those variables will be uncontrollable and we can't do anything about. What we're looking for are those controllable variables that we can do something about and we can make change with. I've got that the next piece talks about cost accounting. When you look at the full cost profile in your report, you know, in the governmental sector, we rely predominantly on cash in and cash out. Well, we found out very quickly we would be unable to compare if we basically looked at general ledgers and just looked at the cash because of the way each municipality does its accounting. So we do a full cost profile. So when you see something that may cost $3 million, that's not only the direct personnel and operating cost of that service, that's also the indirect cost of overhead and staff support and the capital cost in the form of depreciation. There are other benchmarking projects around the country, both regional, and there's one nationwide that's managed by the ICMA, the International City-County Management Association. We are the only benchmarking project that puts this much emphasis on cost accounting because we just think making sure before we start talking about efficiency and effectiveness, you've got to know how much those resources are going into that particular service area in order to provide a service at a particular level. We are the only benchmarking project in the United States that does the full cost profile. And we're one of the only few, when you open your book, that provides this explanatory information. So as opposed to just looking at the data, you have context in which to interpret the data. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about using the comparative statistics. We've been working on some research, going out and doing some case studies with our municipalities, trying to determine why some of the municipalities have used the data and why others have used it more just in a passive way, maybe just as an informational source, and what separates the ones who really have made some valuable change and the ones who haven't. Now, before I get into those four variables, I want to talk about change just a second. What do you mean using the data? What do I mean by that? I have given you a handout here behind the outline that's asphalt maintenance and repair for the city of Hickory. When the report came out in 97-98, and you'll see this average right here in color, you can see the percentage of potholes repaired within 24 hours was much lower in Hickory than compared to the average of the other municipalities. Hickory said, now we have a performance gap here. They ramped up and began to delve down to study what was driving this. They called other municipalities, started trying to identify strategies. They analyzed the data and then through several actions, some of them small. One of the actions was buying a new hot asphalt repair truck. You can see on the back page what happened to those percentage of potholes. The percentage of potholes went from 85% within 24 hours up to 95%, and now they're above the average. A case where they saw a performance gap, they analyzed it, they implemented strategies, and they tracked the outcome. Now, what variables tend to drive some of us to use it and the other municipalities not? And we've identified four. One, the municipalities tend to use it when they rely on those higher order measures of efficiency and effectiveness. When they move beyond just the workload, counting the widgets, and going up into the actual performance. Second, a lot of them, the ones that really relied particularly on that efficiency measure, have made a lot of changes. Because we put so much detail into our cost accounting, those cost per measures provide some powerful information to compare yourselves against. The ones, we have this tendency that we only want to pick out jurisdictions of like sizes, that we're only going to pick out the two or three that mirror our population. The ones who compare themselves against everyone without parsing the data out according to population was much more likely to use the information than the one who tried to segregate based on population. It's this, we get hung up, I think, sometimes that there's some type of economies of scale at work, but typically there's not a huge economies of scale at work in a very labor-intensive service like we are in local government. And finally, the ones who used it more when they incorporated the data into key management decisions. The ones who just brought it in and kind of reviewed the book and felt that, oh, that's good, we're in pretty good shape, we're not likely to use it. The ones of them that tried to bring it into the strategic planning process, tried to do it into their budgeting processes, were trying to do it with program evaluation, were much more likely to kind of find the diamonds in the rough and pull them out and make changes for their municipalities. Again, we greatly appreciate Carber's participation in the North Carolina benchmarking project. And on again, it's the idea that performance measurement is good, it provides good information, but benchmarking, that those interjurisdictional comparisons even provide us with more information. And I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I got a comment.
Okay.
Let's do it.
You know, I found it interesting that I was just kind of going through it, and we seem to do a lot with very little, which is great, you know, and it's a testament to the great staff we have. So, you know, I'm happy about that.
Right. I think overall, I think Carborough found that it was in pretty good shape when you look through all the services. There wasn't any major outliers, which I think that is good and something that we need to let everyone know. Yes.
If you were on this side of the table, what would you consider to be the most important thing or things that we should be taking from your report?
Well, what I always encourage elected officials to do, to review the report, look for information that jumps out at you, not only the good, but some of the things that that maybe needs a little improvement, and then getting back with staff and trying to find out what's behind some of those numbers.
Okay.
And we may find out that it's some of those uncontrollable variables that we can't do anything
mm-hmm.
with. But if we can get behind some of those numbers and find some of those controllable variables, then we can make changes.
Okay.
And so I always encourage elected officials to take a leadership role in this and to review the information.
Thank you.
My question's for Steve. Steve, do you anticipate that part of how you might work with this report is that we might get something from you that identifies areas of opportunity that you find through working on this and strategies for addressing them in the eight areas, you know, so that we can be aware of how this is affecting your view of operations and policy?
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate goal was for us to look ourselves in the mirror and see how we compared not only to ourselves but also to the other jurisdictions and find opportunities where if it looks like our numbers don't look quite as good as somebody else's numbers, we want to know why. And we also hope that other jurisdictions might look at some of our numbers and say, hey, Carborough's doing something really well. What are they doing that we're not doing? So we want to take the time to go through this and find areas where we think we can make improvements and incorporate it as a part of our budget and service delivery process to bring back to you all to say,
you know, here's what it is. And it might be like the situation Bill referenced with Hickory. They had to spend some money in order to make those numbers look better. They didn't have the hot patch truck, and they needed to purchase that to get to the kind of response times that they wanted. There might be something like that. We need a piece of equipment or whatever, or it might be something we just tweak with what we have. If we used a piece of equipment or a crew in a different manner, we might be able to get some efficiencies that we hadn't recognized before by having this comparative data. So I don't intend for this to gather dust on a shelf. Our folks worked really hard to participate, and you know, unless the board directs otherwise, I plan on Carborough being in this for the long haul. This is not, you know, a one-shot deal. I think we're coming up on the third year of this three-year program, and then there's a, I think, a plan to renew it at least for another 3 years.
That's
Bill,
correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
And I certainly want us to be a part of that, because I think it's very valuable to be able to look at ourselves and compare ourselves to other folks and learn from them, and they learn from us.
Alex.
Actually, Dan just asked my question, and Steve answered it. Thank you.
My question has to do with something this board believes, and we're trying to figure it out. How can we make this community a sustainable community from the triple bottom line, as Professor Jim Johnson at Keenan Institute, you know, calls it, you know, from the point of view of social, economic, and environmental sustainability? How can we use these concepts or these benchmarks to incorporate them into, you know, our goals? We have a set of goals that I feel these are really good tools, and they're measurable, and help. Also, we can help us keep good accountability of it. We'd love to get some feedback on how we can use this to beef up or organize the goals that we have of making Carborough. I think by improving these services, by him being more efficient, but you know, it impacts the quality of life of the citizens of Carborough, you know, by having more efficient fire and police services and all that stuff. And do you have some feedback of, you know, other cities who use this data to include them into indicators of create indicators of social, economic, and environmental sustainability?
Well, I've never thought about it from a sustainable community aspect. We are more focused on the administrative, the service delivery side. We're not as focused on the community indicator side from that aspect. But I think from the idea that we want to continue to provide efficient and effective services over the long run, absolutely has impact on being a sustainable community and being able to maximize tax dollars in providing efficient and effective services. And I probably did not answer that as well as you wanted, but I'd have to put a little more thought into the broader concept of the sustainable community and exactly how that ties in.
That might be a good project for students. I think it really would, to have a student work with Carborough to see where the and I know that the students are very into sustainability these days.
Absolutely.
It might be a good.
Absolutely.
You don't have any this summer, I don't think. But
we do not, but it would be an excellent project. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll remember that in the fall, because I think it's a good, be good. Thank you.
I think it's. You know, this document's going to take some time to digest, and I think that's your point, is to take some time with
Absolutely.
It and digest it. And I'm looking forward to doing that. I really appreciate it. I know we all do. This is some great stuff. Thank you.
Okay.
I guess just briefly as a follow-up to the question that Dan asked, Steve, given this is the first time that you've really seen the product in detail, does this product meet your expectations, Steve, in terms of being able to provide you sort of the starting point, starting data to begin that process that you described in response to Dan's question?
Yeah, it does, because, you know, even though the town did participate for a while in this a number of years ago before my time and dropped out for whatever reason. So it's not totally new to the town, and this is not a new project
for the School of Government. So they've gone through lots of iterations with this and really continue to perfect the methodology. So I think it will provide what I want, and I've been involved in a startup benchmarking project when I was in South Carolina with two other counties where we worked with USC to begin a similar project but on a much smaller scale at the county level. So I've had some experience with these things before, and I think this very much will fit into the kind of thing that I think that our departments will be able to put into practice.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Yes.
Thanks, Dave.
Mr. Manager, agenda item number two.
Okay. Item two is our employee market study, and we have John Maxwell, who is a principal with Springstead, and for some of you around the table, you've seen John in here a number of times over the years. John's here to provide a summary of the information that we sent out to you in the agenda packet last week. John?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the board. For the record, I'm John Maxwell. I'm Senior Vice President of Springstead, and we've been engaged by the town, of course, to undertake a market study. Briefly, what I'd like to do is just to explain to you how the study was done and some of the major findings and conclusions and recommendations that we would like to for you to consider. One of the reasons that you want to be sure that you do a market study every once in a while, which you do, is to ensure that your salaries are competitive. That's not to say that they need to be the highest or the lowest, but you need to be competitive. And the reason for that is that if you continue to not be competitive, what becomes is that you become a training ground for other organizations. They get their certifications, they get their experience, and they move on. That's very expensive for you, and of course that impacts what we heard just before in terms of your efficiency and effectiveness. So it's beneficial to the community, it's beneficial to you, it's beneficial to the staff to maintain a competitive salary schedule. What we do is we first select various positions throughout the organization, both in terms of the upper echelon positions, middle management, first level supervisors, professional, technical, clerical, administrative support, to make sure that we've got a broad cross-section of the various positions in the workforce. And we ask these various communities, based upon your job descriptions, we do not survey by job title. We ask these communities, what do you pay someone who does this type of work, who has to have this kind of license, this amount of experience, this level of education, et cetera. It's been our experience that if you survey by job title, you can get very, very misleading information. So we took your job descriptions and we asked these other communities what they pay people who do this type of work. In the past, the town has asked us to provide, and we've done this for a couple of times now, here are the communities that we surveyed. We got information from Morrisville and Garner and Holly Springs and Fuquay Marina, Chapel Hill, Durham, Raleigh, Cary, Apex, Wake County, Durham County, Orange County, the Orange Water and Sewer Authority, and some information from the state of North Carolina. Those organizations were selected primarily because they are in this metropolitan area. We don't have any on eastern North Carolina. We don't have Greenville. We don't have Greensboro. We don't have Asheville. They're not in this market, but these communities are in this market. And you compete for employees within this market. So that's why these organizations were selected, and it's consistent with the communities that we had used in the past. These are basically the same communities that we had used in previous studies. So the data tracks along with that. So what do we find? What after we've got all of this information, we've analyzed it, we've assessed it, we've verified the accuracy of it, and one of the things that we've found is that the town has done a very good job of maintaining a competitive salary schedule. And the reason that is demonstrated by out of approximately 70 job classes, only 9 required a range increase of more than 1 salary grade, which means that you all have really maintained. This is good news not only for the council in terms of what it might cost to implement the study that you have maintained, but also the employees have been paid competitively throughout the years, that they are not very, very far behind. And so I want to congratulate you all, frankly, for maintaining a competitive salary schedule. Another interesting statistic is almost half of your jobs required no salary grade change. They're right where they're supposed to be. And so that is also indicative of paying attention to your major resource in terms of providing services, which is your staff. Another observation we would like to make is that your policy of including COLA as part of your pay-for-performance plan is very beneficial. And the reason for that is beneficial, and it's proven in this data that you have earlier, is that it allows you to provide more information, more data, more salary increases to the existing employees. They're the ones who've been able to provide these services. And so when you add COLA into the cost of living as part of your pay-for-performance, then that allows you then to provide more resources and economic resources and reward the people who have already been here and already produced. And so your plan of implementation in terms of placing more money in the pay-for-performance category rather than the new employees is one of the major reasons, A, why you've been able to maintain a competitive salary schedule, and B, you relate performance to compensation. You've got studies now and you have data. This is a real good program that you have where you have now got benchmarking. You know now that you can relate and employees can relate and supervisors can relate the relationship between compensation and performance. And when you do that and the way you handle that situation follows right along with that philosophy. Now, we didn't benchmark each and every class, not every job. We surveyed, and you don't normally do that for a couple of reasons. First of all, you have some jobs in this organization that are unique to Carrboro, and you're not going to get good comparable data. Secondly, if you ask these other organizations for too much data and ask them to provide too much, they won't fill out the form. So we kind of have to draw a balance here because we want to get their response. So what we do is that we rank and we rate every job. We assign points to it based upon the nature and the complexity of the work, the education, the experience requirements, the supervisory responsibilities. And we point factor each one of them. And then we say, okay, for those for which we have data, this is about the salary grade that they should be in, and this is the number of points they have. For those for which we didn't get salary data, and they got approximately the same number of points, they go in that same salary grade. And that helps you maintain the proper internal relationship among positions, which is what the staff has really tried to do, is work very hard to make sure, regardless of the department that they work, is that if the nature and the complexity of the work is the same and the education and the experience is required are the same and the external relationships are the same, then they should be paid about the same salary regardless of which department. And that's how those figures and how those salary schedules and how those salary ranges are arrived at. So we look at not only the external market, but also for the proper internal relationship among employees and job classes in this organization. So not only are we externally competitive, but internally fair, and that's what we look at. And finally, I just want to emphasize that what we did is we analyzed jobs. We analyzed positions. We didn't look at anything else. We didn't reorganize the town government. We didn't look at whether you're, you know, anything else other than the job. The competency of the employees comes in your pay-for-performance plan and relating that to the previous presentation that you had. I know that is kind of a short presentation. I know you have a lot to say grace over this evening, but, Mr. Mayor, members of the board, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the board has.
Thank you.
As usual, thank you. I find this very useful information. And I know that over the past 2 years, the information you've gotten from our staff has been really helpful, and you've been instrumental in helping us to reexamine how we go about compensating our employees. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And Steve and Bing and Desiree working so hard on this. This question's a little different, and it's a different question than like a market study. It's more of a justice study, of a justice question. I'm concerned, and I know every member of this board is concerned, that Carrboro is paying a livable wage. Mm-hmm. Is Carrboro paying a livable wage? Do you know what a livable wage would be for our part of Orange County?
If I recall, to answer your question directly, I haven't taken a look at that in the last couple of years.
But okay.
If I recall, your beginning hourly wage is right around $11 an hour, $10.50, $11.
We have the livable wage. Is that right?
Where's Desiree?
It's 9:34, and the minimum hourly rate for somebody who started at the lowest pay grade at the minimum, which we don't have anybody
right.
at right now, but that's 9.75, the
okay.
actual lowest per hour rate that we have right now is $11.30,
okay.
so about $2 above the livable wage.
I know over the years we've done a pretty good job of kind of getting rid of some of our very lowest salaries. We did that, I guess, over 10 years ago. We said nobody would make below 20, I think it was. But that was some time ago.
Yeah, the board, I mean, there is, you know, I know you know this, Jackie, but the board has a policy
right.
of paying a livable wage, and we try to make sure over time that the classification and pay system reflects that board policy so that we don't fall below that.
Okay. And I guess what I was getting at is that still a livable wage?
Certainly, does
the livable wage go up? I mean, it's nine something an hour, we think, but is that still the livable wage for Orange County?
That's the latest information.
Okay.
That's the latest information that we have. Orange County is looking at perhaps adjusting that this year, and we generally follow the county.
Okay.
And keep in mind, if the board adopts the pay for performance plan that we proposed, the minimum and maximum of the pay grades would increase by 2.5%.
Okay. Yeah. So we're okay.
You're right. In good shape.
All right. Thank
yes,
you.
Ma'am.
Thank you so much for the good news. I'm not surprised knowing the brilliant staff that we have in this town. I'm curious to know if this is a statistician in me. How many cities did you survey, and what was the response rate of the survey?
We did 10 cities and 3 counties, the Orange Water Sewer Authority, and the state.
And what was the response rate on the survey?
I think we got information from all of them. Not every position, of course. Some of them didn't have every position, but every of these communities, they all responded. We got data from all of them.
And they do this voluntarily, or you have to give them an incentive?
Well, we had to ask a couple of them, a couple more than once, to participate. What we do is we say, you know, after we have made this presentation to you, we will share this data with them, but only after you have received it. And okay. so that's part of the incentive for them to participate. But to my recollection, I think we got, I don't have all of the responses here in front of me, but as I recall, we got salary data from all of these communities participated, which is unusual. We normally don't get 100% participation, but I think we got some of them. We had to call more than once, but that's all right. We still got it.
John, the other thing is many of these jurisdictions also contact us for similar information, and Desiree and Tamara are very good about responding back. So I think most folks in local government try to help each other, and they know that, you know, their day will come to ask us for information. And so if they have been hesitant to share with us, we might not be quite as quick to share with them. So,
sure. Does the study include, so this was just local governments, WASA and counties, or did it include also job description from the private sector?
We didn't get any information from the private sector, no. It was just local governments.
Would you say private sector pay higher or similar?
You know,
how competitive are we with
some of the studies we've done in other communities in North Carolina and in Virginia, where we've gotten private sector data, it's been our experience that particularly at the administrative support, in the paraprofessional, in the technical area, and in certain entry-level professional positions, the cities are very competitive. Obviously, as you get into the department head, your chief financial officer and your human resources director and your department director is no. Cities are not, in local government, are not competitive with the private
sector. Which leads me to the next question, which is I would be interested in knowing what sort of other non-cash incentives do other cities provide, like housing for firemen and teachers and police officers?
Some of them do. It's
What ideas that we might not have here that we should be thinking kind of outside the box that...
Well, some of them provide, for example, some of them provide low-interest loans. Some of them have provided, but there's a quid pro quo for that in terms of, you know, if we pay you, then you have to stay with us so far. And if, you know, so they provide low-interest loans. They provide maybe an extra housing allowance for them, there are a variety of different ways, and some of them, obviously, there are tax implications to that that need to be taken careful look at. But one of the things, when you get into that I want to just caution the board to be sure that you don't cause yourself an inequity problem within your own organization. I just, you know, you work, the staff and you all have worked very hard in terms of maintaining the proper relationship among positions. And while there may very well be reasons to do what you've done or thinking or might want to do, that just as a word of caution, you might solve one problem and create another. That's my only caution.
Appreciate that advice. And finally, how important is language? You know, I mean, the United States, the whole country is changing, and around here, I hear the North Carolina is developing an accent, and so I'm an accent and community, of course. And I hear that the schools and health sectors and governments are in more need of bilingual personnel. Is language compensated in other communities?
You mean multiple, the ability, multilingual, bilingual, or in some instances, in some positions it is, yes, sir. In some positions it is. I know way back when I was with a community in Colorado, I worked for a and we had a large Hispanic community, and we paid police officers and firefighters and building inspectors, if they learned another language, you gave them a stipend. But we, you know, it has to be really unique to that particular job. And, you know, that's where the criteria needs to be very carefully thought out when you provide those types of incentives, to be sure that all employees, if it's related to the job, then it's easy to say we'll give everybody a certain percentage, but some jobs require that more than others.
Yeah, I mean, it's critical. Yeah,
in some instances, it is. Yes, sir.
Do we have that in our pay grade? Do we recognize the...
There's no specific recognition for that, no. I don't believe, Desiree.
No.
I mean, if we were attempting to recruit a position and that appeared to be a key criteria, that might be a reason to start an employee at something above the minimum. We have that kind of flexibility, but you wouldn't see anything in a policy manual that says if you speak a language, you're entitled to X.
Okay.
I mean, you have to be careful. It has to be related to their job. I mean, it might not be important a particular job and just say because I can speak Spanish or French or German, therefore, I should get this certain stipend or additional pay. Why is that language requirement important, and how does the community benefit? How does the organization benefit from that?
Thank you.
Alex.
Just to go back to an old bugaboo, I take it from your comments, John, you've been with us through this process for however many years. As we all recall, some years ago, throughout the organization and in certain departments, we got into a fairly severe problem with salary compression. I understand from your comments that the budgets that Bing and Steve have put together and pay plans that have been implemented
have kept that problem in check.
That's correct.
Am I interpreting your comments correctly?
That's correct. That's exactly why you put your money in there, so that the people move through across the pay grade based upon their performance.
And that hasn't manifested itself in a market study in several years, has it?
That's correct.
Great.
Yeah. So
the
you're
last
right.
Couple anyway.
That's really a good program that you've all started.
Great. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the board. Appreciate it. Once again, it was a real pleasure working with the staff on this project. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay. Mr. Manager, there appear to be people in the back of the room with orange patches on their shirts.
Yes. We have a presentation on 800 megahertz countywide radio conversion. Jack Ball is our director of emergency management. Jack, you're going to introduce your colleague.
Yes, this is Eric Griffin.
Thank
He's handing out handouts. He's my emergency management specialist. Mr. Mayor, members of the Alderman, I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you today, give you a update on the radio system and the conversion process that we're going through. I'm going to start off by just briefly going through a little bit of history on the whole process. Back in 2000, it was determined that a study should be done by the commissioners to examine our current public safety communication capabilities and the multiple inadequacies that were becoming more and more apparent. Since 2000, the county has funded a consultant who's CTA out of Lynchburg, and they analyzed the conditions of our present systems and made recommendations on how to improve and move forward. They met with all the agencies and the partners that we have, which includes the three municipalities and our volunteer fire and rescue partners, and the law enforcement in the Sheriff's Department. Some of the deficiencies that were identified were dispatcher access. When units were in the field trying to communicate back, the dispatchers were not being able to be available because of the minimum staffing that was at that time did not allow them to communicate effectively to all the units that were demanding. In addition, there was no interoperability between the different agencies. A police officer from Chapel Hill had a very difficult time in communicating with a police officer from Carrboro. A fire department from Chapel Hill and a fire department from Carrboro or outside in the county had a very difficult time because we were different radio frequencies. In the system of today, there are approximately four different radio systems in operation. That's a low-band VHF system, a high-band VH system, a UHF system, and a 800 system. And there's a combination between the different agencies of all these systems. So that leads to a major inability to provide intercooperation on an emergency or disaster scene. The reduced mobile coverage existed within the county and frequently had dead spots. With the systems that we had, there are not enough towers and repeaters to give you a constant coverage throughout the county. So many of those agencies that were operating outside of the municipal jurisdictions were running into problems communicating back to the dispatch center to get additional resources or provide progress reports. There was no redundancy in the communication system itself, and this was very evident by an ice storm in 2002 that took out our primary tower, and we had to resort into dispatching through telephone lines to the different agencies. Since then, there has been some additional upgrades at the tower site to ensure that we do have radio generator backup to maintain that site. And there was current channel crowding, which meant that the responders, there were too many of them trying to talk on the same channel. So a lot of times the traffic was overridden by someone else that had a stronger signal or was closer. So there was a lot of problems there with trying to maintain control. It should be noted that CTA identified that public safety agencies in Orange County, including Carrboro, had become so adapted that these inadequacies had not resulted in any obvious communication failures at the time. They learned over the time frame to adapt to the deficiencies to operate. The county's consultant analyzed Orange County's radio system from 2001 until 2004 and made a recommendation of a solution utilizing the 800 megahertz platform system. The 800 platform would provide the county to address the deficiencies that I just spoke about, plus also provided an additional capability for future operations. The system's capability to support current operations and be expanded at a minimum of 10 years in the future. So you could expand and build on this system, whereas today with the four different systems that we had, there was very limited expansion capabilities. The radio system was necessary. Coverage improved the existing system. With the new system, you would get additional coverage, so those dead spots that I spoke about earlier would dissipate, and you would not have as many of them, but provide additional capabilities countywide. Provide mobile-to-mobile, mobile-to-portable, portable-to-portable, mobile-to-portable to the dispatch communication. Basically, what this means that regardless of whether you were in your car, your fire truck, or on a handheld radio, you could talk directly into the communication center to ensure you had adequate contact to get the resources that may be needed and requested. Provide communication security with digital encryption capability for sensitive areas. This was something we presently don't have, but with the new system will provide for law enforcement for many of those sensitive areas where they have to go in and make arrests, where they don't want people with scanners listening and determining where the police officers are or what they're doing. So that is a capability of the new system. Provide local interoperability for Orange County, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Hillsborough, UNC, Chapel Hill, public safety agencies within the county, the other public safety, the fire. That means during a major disaster, all of our agencies will have the capability to intercommunicate with each other. Regardless, if we had to send fire trucks from Hillsborough, they would be able to come down and function right in with the Carrboro fire units or the police officers. Maintain the capability to access North Carolina's medical communications network. It's very important for myself to ensure that we do have that capability to contact the hospitals and to contact other EMS agencies. Provide 800 megahertz mutual aid repeaters for emergency responders having 800 equipment that's not compatible. Durham County and Durham City, just right across the lines, have an 800 system, and they have a analog system. The new system that we are looking at and we're working on will have that capability for them to interface directly with us, so they will not have to have a problem communicating, even though they have a different type of 800 trunking system or a conventional system, and maintain some of the VHF-UHF conventional communications capabilities to provide interoperability with those organizations, such as our surrounding counties of Caswell, Alamance, that have those types of agencies, and be able to interface with our 800 system, and also serve as a backup so we won't have those problems if we have a 800 radio failure. We'll have a VHF or a UHF backup in operation. Our project update today, all these projects consist of several different things. Infrastructure, which is towers and antennas and repeaters, our user equipment, which are portable radios and mobile radios, and our console equipment, which is located at our communication center, our telecommunication center. All that composes of this whole system. One of these systems cost, I've put in two when I was operating in my previous employment in Virginia, these systems average in the neighborhood of $26 to $27 million. That's to operate on a major system. One of the decisions that was made that we were going to partner with another agency in the state, which was the state police, that already had an 800 radio system in place. We were going to be able to partner, utilize infrastructure there, and additional towers placed, and that would provide us a great savings, which we have. We have done a tremendous amount of savings in putting this system together. The tower projects completed at a rapid pace, and we're still working on it. The Highway Patrol has got all the critical components necessary to put in all the towers to operate. We have one tower operating already at the Eno Mountain site, which is located in Hillsborough. We have a tower that's in the process of being built up at Lawls Road store area in the northern part of the county. There was an old Piedmont tower that has worked with us to be able to utilize that. We also have a tower at the UNC tower down here in across the border that is operational at this time and gives us some communication capability. We have an additional tower that's being placed at UNC at one of their buildings at the UNC campus, which will give us a tremendous amount of coverage, especially for Carrboro, Chapel Hill area, and the surrounding outlying community that are with you. All these are in operational or online to be in operational. So the tower system is working fairly well right now. We've taken some of our portable radios and have ridden around the county and have been able to talk back to the communication center across the county on the portable radios in the areas where some of the towers are actually operating today. We expect to have full coverage of our county once these towers are completed. And as you can see from the attachment that came with what Eric gave you, its coverage are shown in yellow with some reduction in transmission in the colors orange to blue. So those that are in yellow are the highest capabilities of coverage that we'll be able to get within Orange County, and that's at a worst-case scenario, and that's portable talking back to the communications center. Should be noted that we have partial coverage on the southern portion of the county already around Hillsborough, and Carrboro Fire Department has successfully deployed the 800 radio on a limited test during the apple chill that we just recently had. We were able to get some radios, provide them to Chief Crabtree, and they were able to utilize those on the existing tower and had some success with that. We've also utilized them on a couple of other events around the county. The radio programming template is almost complete. One of the things that we had to do, we had the partners as who were going to be able to communicate with who on a regular basis, who was going to be able to needed to communicate in disaster areas, and how were we going to set those radios up as far as the programming. So we would know who, what channels are on what knob. We've almost completed that template. Hopefully by the end of this month that'll be available. We'll be able to start programming radios and be able to start utilizing on a minimum use of the radios. Our 911 center radio upgrades are proceeding at a very rapid pace. We have quotes in return. We will proceed with purchasing in the upcoming months. That's the console equipment and the interface that we're going to have at the 911 center. There will be some delay on the installation due to some remodeling that we have to do at the communication center, but the goal is to have that work completed before the end of the calendar year. So we're hopefully we'll be able to have that operational before the end of the calendar year. How is this radio system funded? I think that's one concern that many of us have. And in the 2004 Homeland Security grant, funding began to be the issued. The state started handing out those Homeland Security grants on a competitive basis. This resulted in a lot of requirements in the competitive basis, and those organizations that were looking for interoperability received a higher ranking when they started looking at the progress. Since we had so many partners, we were ranked up there high and was able to leverage that partnership to be able to obtain funding to do both the infrastructure and some limited field user equipment. Orange County could, once we worked with the Highway Patrol, we'll be sharing the towers with the Highway Patrol. That benefits them from their officers being able to travel deep within the county and still have communication capabilities, because our towers that we're putting in to serve our community will also serve the Highway Patrol. It's a shared resource. Orange County will be able to utilize the 800 system with a relative ease once the user radios and dispatch consoles are purchased and in place. So we're getting closer and closer to that point where we'll be able to put this system into operation. However, as I said earlier, this is an expensive process in getting the radio equipment and the cost of the radios. We're actually buying computers. The radios today are not the radios of our ancestors. The ones we had when I was riding a fire truck were tube-operated. These today are actually programmed computers. So there is a higher cost associated with those. Prior to the Homeland Security grants, they had paid for planning services, our consultants. These monies have all been utilized by Homeland Security to get where we are. Additionally, Homeland Security grants paid for a small catch of user radios. It will provide a minimum level of capability once we have the towers operational and our dispatch consoles operational. Through these grants, the county was able to procure 24 radios for the town of Carrboro, valued at approximately $70,508. So that's one portion of the grant that we were able to utilize for our partner here in Carrboro. Same cost-wise or with our other municipal organizations and our volunteer partners. The total amount of federal grants received by the county have been dedicated to the communication project and the Homeland Security and the radio infrastructure. Today, we've been able to leverage $3,606,741 in grant funding to build this system. Of this amount, the town of Carrboro is receiving direct benefit through the radio towers, the 911 dispatch center, the maintenance of the legacy VHF-UHF system, and the 24 radios that we've previously purchased. We are still pursuing other grants on behalf of the entire county, including the town of Carrboro, and our successes will gladly be shared with all our partners when we do obtain grants. Steps the town of Carrboro may take to possibly offset the cost of these systems. Again, since this system is being built on in a step-by-step basis, it's not one that we have to automatically shut down today and start tomorrow, which would incur a large cost. So we're gradually phasing this type of system in, allowing our partners to be able to budget for their radio systems to add to the ones that we've already purchased and the ones that we are pursuing. The town may consider joining a number of other jurisdictions in requesting funding directly through the Congressional Earmark Funds. Many of our congressmen out there have funds that they call it pork barrel in the public arena. And I think that by utilizing our contacts with our congressmen and our senators and our legislation, that would be able to help leverage some additional grant funding and other funds that could go towards this. Third option is for the town to pursue is to request that the state federal delegation make available more local funding for the 800 system. Now, I see that that's one of the legislative agendas that our neighbors right next door is doing with our state legislating, trying to get additional 800 funds put into this that will help all of us in the end. Again, I talked about the phased-in approach. It's obvious the remaining costs are large and could be overly burdensome if incorporated at the same time. However, because the system is flexible as it is, the agencies may be able to be brought on to the system in phases, such as for specific events like Halloween, Hog Day, administrative uses for non-emergency communications until we get everything operational. I'll be happy to hear any questions you might have.
Thank you so much for all the great work you guys do to keep us safe. And sounds like the only thing we're missing are microphones in every single house, you know. So we're all really going to be interconnected. Governor Easley has announced that he has made a priority funding of emergency services. This Friday we're meeting with our delegation for the North Carolina. Is there a particular grant that you folks wrote? Should we submit a bill? Right now we still have time to submit bills, local bills, through our delegation to request specific funding. Do we know? I mean, you're encouraging us to ask.
Yes, sir.
But you have to be. I know that this week actually the money, the $2 billion surplus is going to be gone. So if we're going to ask for support, I want to know what bill or what grant, or if we need to drop something really quick to get it
there. I think one of the things that could be done by the board is to request that they do support the funding for the Viper system. That's the system that we're operating. That's where the radio system throughout the whole state. The whole intent of the Viper system is to have an interoperability from the coast to the mountains, which means that a law officer, a police officer, a medic can respond anywhere in North Carolina with their radio equipment and be able to fit right in to an existing operation at a disaster. So I could send my medics and my emergency management people to the coast and the mountain with our equipment and just go to a different talk group. There's a statewide talk group that all our radios will have, Carbers including, that will be assigned through the state police that will assign that, and we would go to that particular talk group and talk to the people. So my answer is to yes, urge that your legislatives do support the Viper system.
And how much money? How much money is that Viper system?
The Viper system over the whole state, I'm not exactly sure, but it's in the upwards of millions of dollars. It's I did one system in one county for $21 million. So we're looking at 100 counties, and based on just a rough guess, $200 million would be a rough guess based on what I did before.
Well, we got $2 billion surplus, you know.
That would eat it up real quick.
Yeah,
really, there's only $800 million.
Let me just mention, remind you all, I think I mentioned this at the budget presentation last week, we are planning on applying for about a $100,000 fire grant, and I think those will be approved in September. So that would be one thing that we could probably mention to the delegation, is that money's already out there for somebody, and if they could assist with that. And then remind you all, I don't think Jack knows exactly what our proposal is, but just to remind the board, we've got $150,000 proposed in the budget for next year, plus looking at lapsed salaries in the police and fire department budgets this year to try to get a jump on the system. And then depending on what kind of grant funding we might be able to get in the coming year, the plan would be in fiscal year 07-08 approximately another $150,000, so that, Jack, our plans are to be fully operational by the end of fiscal year 07-08 if the board goes along with what we've proposed. So that, I think you had talked, I don't think you mentioned it tonight, but in one of our earlier meetings we talked about maybe as much as a four-year implementation phase. I'm concerned about making sure that Carrboro gets moving as quickly as we can, so that we're not at the tail end of getting our folks with the opportunity to be able to converse safely with each other out in the field.
Thank you very much.
Well, I do want to leave you with one more thing, and I appreciate y'all allowing me to speak. But in public safety, I had an old captain before that talked to me about the radio systems and really impressed upon me. He said, Jack, I've been in the police department for over 32 years. I have to qualify every year with my sidearm, and I pulled my sidearm one time. He says, I depend on my radio every day. So that's a very crucial piece of equipment for our public safety agencies. And again, thank you all for your support and for working with us in this process.
Thank you for all you do.
Thanks, Jack.
Board members.
Just a brief question for Steve, and I guess Carolyn can just answer this as well. As I understand it, under the current system, in order to achieve interoperability, particularly in events where there are multiple jurisdictions, it's true that officers and emergency personnel often have to carry multiple radios.
It involves more than one radio. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Travis, you all have to carry at least two radios to be able to talk to the police department.
So here we are in the 21st century, and our emergency personnel are operating in an environment which is like a 1930s Abbott and Costello routine with phones on the table. So this is long overdue.
You can know our ancestors.
Yeah.
So by 07-08, that should be complete for Carver?
If, based on what we know now, we should be fully operational with mobile units in the vehicles, portable units on the officers and firefighters in the field.
And that would give us interoperability with the Triangle region as well, or?
In
the fire portion of it would allow us to talk anywhere from Wilmington to Charlotte along the interstate corridor, and as they add more and more towers to the Viper system, that will only expand under the current fleet mapping system, it would cover all of Durham and Orange counties, which is our primary goal, mm-hmm. and those are the closest to us.
Great.
Travis, that would that include Wake County as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I like the name, I was thinking they never come up with like the fuzzy bunny system or anything, but the Vipers. All right. Are there other budget matters that the board members would like to bring up? I have two little things, but
I have a bunch of things actually, but they're all relatively small. And in fact, in preface, let me just say I read through this document page by page over the weekend, and I really want to commend all the department heads as well as the town manager's office for the stewardship that's embodied in this document, because I think really in terms of the growth of town services and the quality of town services, that those are disproportionate to the increase in spending that we're seeing, and I think you all are doing a great job. And so the points I have are all fairly minor, so I'll just run through them. First, I have a question which has to do with the fire station hires. By the way, this decision package review booklet is great, so whoever thought of that, it's really a nice format. There's a bunch of the line item costs there that breaks it down. There's a number of items, maybe about 30-some percent of the total, that I take to be one-time costs, and the bulk of it, the salaries and such, being repeating costs. Is that correct?
That's correct. The uniforms, the portable radios, those kind of things would be one-time cost.
Okay.
For a period of time, obviously, over time they'd have to be replaced, but the primary ongoing cost would be the salaries and fringe benefits for the future.
Okay. Then I have two concerns that are related to areas under my own professional expertise. First has to do with the GIS system upgrade. When the GIS, as the document explains here, is currently a Microsoft Access database, which is my own, where my own professional emphasis is. And the two limitations that are described, which is the limit on the data and the limit for more than one person to edit a file at a given time, it's not actually correct that those are intrinsic limits to access databases. So unless there's some positive elements in the spatial database engine that warrant that change, which are not really identified here, I think that should be looked at very carefully, because access can be improved to have complete shareability and unlimited users for, probably no more than a quarter of the cost that's identified here in terms of programming expense. It's actually, automated in terms of how to move access to what's called a SQL Server environment. And, Steve, if you want me to, I would be happy to meet with Trish, assuming that she's who handles us, and look over that database.
Andy's really the person. Trish, okay, that's not Trish's area of expertise.
And I don't know that we should get into a whole technical discussion tonight, but I want to raise that as a concern.
Okay. We'll do whatever you like, but Andy and Ruth Heaton would be the two people that have the technical background. It's not me.
Okay. But my point basically is that I think if SDE offers benefits that are worth the $16,000 conversion, then that's you know, that that something should be evaluated. But the problems that are identified and attributed to access do not rise to that cost level and can be corrected. So, you know, maybe Andy and I can talk after about that if you'd like, or I don't know if you want,
however you all want to do it.
It won't be very meaningful for me, that's for sure.
I think it's really a practical point. Discuss it among yourselves.
I get into conversations with my buddies who are software engineers, and they can go on for hours on this sort of subject matter, so I would defer to Dan to talk
to Andy
about it.
Let's get the two of you together to discuss that if there's more that we need to look at here.
Okay, good,
then
I'll do that.
Please.
Then the other is a related matter, which has to do with the server replacement, because this idea of a three-year replacement cycle as standard practice really jumped out at me as not valid. And I'm not a networking expert myself, but I contacted two colleagues who are and asked them that question, whether they thought this was true. And here's a response from someone who installs a lot of, basically his business is installing and supporting network systems. And he says, I've replaced servers that were 6 to 7 years old recently, and only because the business needs exceeded the capacity of the server. I used to say that the average desktop replacement cycle was 3 to 5 years, but most well-built systems these days will go 5+ years, although they may require some upgrades during this time. All the more so for servers which were built with more robust hardware. I would say 7 years, barring a need for major software upgrades that cannot be accommodated by the existing hardware. So basically my point is that, so here's $24,000 that may be being spent prematurely, and the budget document doesn't identify where the idea came from that we need this three-year cycle. But it shouldn't be, I mean, I don't believe it's true that there's some industry standard that we need to follow there. It should be specific to the hardware needs of our organization. In other words, what is the quality of the hardware that we're using currently? How is it the capacity? How is the response time? What kind of downtime are we experiencing? Should drive those decisions. So, again, not knowing how this decision has been made, I would either like more, I'd like more information on that, or, you know, perhaps, you know, you might want to get a second opinion, you know, from a professional in the networking field. Because I think that those expenses can perhaps be stretched out over a longer time period and save us some money.
No, come up to the mic just so everybody can hear.
Just because this, actually, we are about a 5.5-year replacement cycle. We have 22 servers, and we're trying to replace 4 of them. I'm saying it would be the ideal to replace 3. I really believe that is true. The longer these servers go past 3 years, Dell has their warranties to 3 years because they know statistically after 3 years they become unreliable in one way or another. And then it takes IT time to babysit them for software glitches. As you know, you'll have more like blue screens occasionally when a system gets older, memory starts going bad. You have to diagnose which memory stick's bad, stuff like that.
The memory problem we have?
Oh, yeah. Are you talking the users or the
the hardware? I will say this. Just address your your concerns there. We're basically on a 5.5-year cycle with our server, so we are getting good use. We still have the very first server that we ever purchased from Dell, and I've been here 6.5 years, and we're still using that.
Okay.
So we get very good service out of our servers. It'd be great if we get on a 3-year cycle. We're Carborough, and we do our best, and we make our money go a long distance with our technology.
All right. Thank you. That addresses that.
While we got you there in the stand, a really quick question. With these technologies you're going to purchase, would this allow us to, stream, what's the language, stream our meetings so that people can hear us or see us?
We looked into that, and we do actually, as you know, we stream after the fact. We don't do live streaming. We looked into doing live streaming.
It takes the whole, you know, effort away. But
well, I will say this: we can definitely, because I've discussed this with Steve, we could try it with our current software. I hate to put that expectation in front of you, saying that it'll happen with it. We can definitely give it a try and see if it meets the end user needs. And if it does, everybody's happy with it. We do have a system in place to do it. We just haven't used that functionality, because that functionality, once you turn it on, anybody who would connect would use bandwidth. And that bandwidth builds as more and more people connect. So realistically, right now with our connection, if nobody, and we also have to remember that our bandwidth is used by our wireless project also. And so that's kind of unpredictable. And it's used more at night than it is during the days also, which when board meetings are showing. But if you were to take full bandwidth up with, like, the streams that would look nice, that are basically shown when you look at the internet, you could get about 6 streams out of here at a time, which might be good or it might not be good. So that's why we looked into a service where we could basically send to a single service and then they'd rebroadcast for us, and they could handle, you know, endless amount of bandwidth. And we'd pay variably according to that bandwidth that was used. And does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Well, maybe if we do that, that means all these journalists will come here. They're just going to log in their homes, in the comfort of their home, and just watch the whole meeting. Better delay that project, right?
Just like they wanted it on.
Keep some company with us here.
I guess one, just on that same subject briefly, I think one thing that may that could potentially affect our thinking about that is that there, at both at the state and the federal level, there are efforts ongoing to basically remove all of our franchising power over cable TV systems, and if either of those legislative disasters pass, then one consequence of that would be perhaps, apparently, I should say, that we would lose our government access channel on our local cable franchise, which means that cable customers could no longer watch this exciting program that we're bringing to them live right now. And so I'll just point out that at some, you know, if something as dire as that happened, I think it would become more of a priority for us to be figuring out a way to get the information out over the internet. So.
Possibly talk to Biblio and see what they'd be willing to do with us. Partner with them, possibly.
It's an interesting talk. All right.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Okay. My next concern is more, it's like a policy question for us, and it's a very small matter, which is to do with the increase in the Art Center grant, which is $1,000 to support the architect for their new building. And my concern is that new building is part of a development that's going to be come before us for review, and that it really, you know, I think it's a different kind of funding than our regular funding that's more kind of ongoing programmatic support for the Art Center, and, you know, it may not legally be any, you know, kind of conflict of interest or bind, but I just think it doesn't seem quite right that we should be funding something that's then going to come to us for review. And given that it's only $1,000 for us or for them out of the $90,000 they need to raise, you know, that perhaps they'll understand if, you know, if you all agree that maybe we shouldn't do that.
Could I mention that they actually asked for $5,000, not $1,000? Go ahead.
Why?
Why?
Why are they asking for money for the architect? I mean, you know, there's. I'd love to see.
You might give it to him.
I'd love to see the architect's total bill for that whole project and all the things that the Art Center does. Why on earth would they ask us for money for an architect?
Clarifying information, although I have to be very careful.
Exactly.
So I'm not advocating anything. This is merely clarifying information as I understand it, which is that the Art Center is not utilizing the architect that is doing the 300 project in general. These are two separate projects because they're separate owners. The Art Center actually owns its own building and its own property, so that's going to be a separate enterprise. However, the point that you raise is true, that eventually that project would have to come before this board, so that's a legitimate question. I don't know the answer to that. However, again, These are, as a matter of permitting, as I understand it, going to be two separate projects, and the Art Center is not a signatory to the conditional use permit that is currently under review, unless that information is out of date.
Well, why don't we get that information directly from the people who do it and then get a opinion from our attorney on the issue of conflict of interest?
I mean, there will ultimately have to be some level of immigration.
There's no need of us talking about it. I mean, it could be easily resolved if we get some answer that it is a conflict and we don't have to talk about policy because it's a conflict.
I would just add, it would not be uncommon for local government to be paying for the planning and even the construction of an affordable housing development that the same governing board has to review and make a decision about whether to permit. So right. This is not an unfamiliar situation altogether. Maybe
I would add that there's some controversy about that in some locations next door to us.
Well, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. Right. I was actually thinking of exactly that situation. The town of Chapel Hill paid for all the planning for the Sunrise Road development.
Well, they should. But you don't want me to get started on that. But they should. I applaud them for doing that.
Okay.
One
next
of the few things I applaud.
Well, so could we get some response at some point from the staff about that issue,
okay, sure,
clarification of what the status is and whether there's a potential conflict problem.
Or, alternatively, we could just not do it since it's not that much money.
Well, I'm just kind of curious about it.
Okay. Then my final two items are small things that I would like to hope that we might be able to include. One is, and this has been on my mind since we had the OWASA presentation 2 months ago, which is whether we could begin a program of installing flush-free urinals in our men's room, and particularly if we might be able to start in the coming fiscal year with installing them in a few of our more public restrooms, whether in the parks or in the Century Center or whatnot, where they would be visible and there could perhaps even be some water conservation information displayed along with them. But according to the vendors, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, these pay for themselves in water savings in only a few years. But even if it's, they say 2 to 3 years, but even if it's 5 or 6 years, it would be a smart investment. It's certainly a good thing to do environmentally, and it's very much in line with the kinds of conservation measures we were talking about when OWASA came here, and we were talking about that whole long-range water capacity question. My thinking is that, if we could find perhaps $5,000, would be enough to buy and install a few of them. So if that's something you could just...
Let me turn to the female end of the table for comments.
I don't mind a change in toilets that use less water. But sometimes, just because of how number of women bathrooms there are, you're stuck waiting in line for a long time. And I'm sort of a proponent of unisex bathrooms after having been pregnant twice and in line in places where I had to go. And the men were just coming in and out, and all of us women were in line. So I know that sounds crazy, but that is sort of a...
I don't think they have flush-free urinals for women yet.
But a toilet that used less water. it's a legitimate concern.
Yes.
So I just say that. I think it's a great idea for the installation, but I think also you have to think that when half of the population stays in line a little longer. That's why. I mean, when there's a line out for the women's, I go in the men's bathroom here in Lockport.
So
that's a misdemeanor in North Carolina.
You go much further down this road.
Oh, God.
New styles.
100%. Yeah, and let's just.
It might be only a civil infraction. I'm not sure.
Okay.
There is a law about it. Anyway, okay, but I think basically the point is not so much exactly what technology we use as to set aside some money to improve our water use.
Let me add that UNC has installed hundreds of these flush-free urinals on campus under the auspices of Carborough's own Cindy Shea and her office over there. So, you know, certainly the knowledge of, you know, what's involved and the economics of this is, you know, is readily available to us. Plus also perhaps a, you know, some information, some research that's already been done in terms of the best sources.
Well, there must be some state purchasing contract.
Yeah, I would support the research to find out how cost efficient it is, because what sticks out in my mind is that we tabled the upgrading of the restrooms at Wilson Park,
right,
which are for both sexes, but also, I mean, the bathrooms out there are poor. And if we have to table something like that at a facility that is so well used, I wouldn't mind researching, you know, the flush urinals. So, but I certainly would think that, you know, we need to upgrade facilities we have before.
So
we
you're saying that because we don't have $120,000 to upgrade the bathrooms there, we shouldn't spend $5,000 on something that will pay for itself in just a few years?
No, I'm saying we should do the research to see if it's going to, it would pay
okay,
for itself.
Okay, so if it pans out, then
if it pans out,
okay,
yeah,
thank
but
you.
I.
But not just urinals.
Right.
Right.
Well.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing I want to mention, and this is just to get this out there because it's something we've been talking about, is that, you know, there may be something that we're going to want to do in terms of insurance coverage that addresses the question of community groups wanting to have events, and, you know, that, you know, we have coming up as an agenda item that I assume we won't make any decision in time for this budget cycle, but, you know, that I doubt that we'd want to spend too much on that, but if there was a way to address that problem with a relatively small expenditure, I think that's something, based on our recent discussions, that we would all want to be able to do.
Or at what point would that be feasible to discuss?
So that's everything I had.
Well, we're going to give you all a menu of choices for the insurance question for the community groups.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I have just two real quick things that I was hoping the staff could help us look into. I understand we did briefly have a presentation sometime last year about this real-time information system for the bus system for Chapel Hill Transit about when the buses arrive and that kind of thing. And I understand that that Chapel Hill Transit has moved forward to sign some type of contract with this company, Next Bus or whatever, and some questions have been raised about the cost of it and so forth. I was hoping the staff could get us a little bit of information about that program in terms of from Carborough's perspective, how many of those real-time information things are going to be at Carborough stops and what Carborough taxpayers essentially are being asked to pay for that service. And then the other matter is, and I think this is not so much for this year's budget cycle, but I understand that Orange County, I read in the papers that Orange County is looking at creating some kind of tax assistance program for very low-income taxpayers that would assist them in paying their tax bills, and that maybe one or two other counties in North Carolina have done that. And just like to ask the staff to keep us apprised of what Orange County is doing in that regard so that we can think about what, if anything, along those lines, the town of Carborough might do
Thank you.
Actually, this is just to add a little bit of information, although obviously you'll probably want to get it from Steve, but that the next bus system is funded primarily by a federal grant.
Right.
There is a small local match. I don't know, remember what the figure is, but it's quite small. But your question about where the stops are going to go is a good one, because we haven't been asked that question as far as I know.
I'm just curious.
We'll find out.
Okay.
But in any case, that the
yeah, so where mostly it's being paid for.
Yeah, because that's several hundred thousand dollar figure. People freak out, but that is
federal
almost entirely from a federal grant.
Was there one more thing down here? If not, I just wanted to say one last thing. I should have mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, which is that I know I saw a bunch of you and or your children at Carborough Day. And although the weather did not really cooperate with us, I thought we had a really great Carborough Day nonetheless. It was a lot of fun over at the Century Center. And I think our probably a number of departments, but especially the folks at the Parks and Recreation and Parks Department deserve a lot of credit for pulling it off under difficult circumstances.
Well done.
Thanks very much.
Yes. Well done. Well done.
Can I mention one other thing?
Please do.
I think Dan mentioned about the decision package information being helpful, and I appreciate that, but I'd be remiss if I didn't give credit to Bing and Drew for going through the information from the departments and trying to put everything together and hopefully a short form so that you all could get through it without going to sleep too many times. So thanks to them.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add one more thing on the budget, which is that you will notice for the second year in a row the absence of what Chief Hutchinson coined Alex's infamous picky list. And that's because he presented us with a budget that presents no tax increase, satisfies the department heads, and moves us forward in the CIP. So given that, I feel no need to pick. And
what's to complain about?
I would ask, there was a tentative second budget work session for May 18th. Staff is obviously fine not to, but if you all feel the need, we certainly are prepared.
I think that the questions that have been raised here, we're looking for informational responses to, and that there's not a lot of need for further discussion on it.
So. We can get those to you.
All right. Thanks very much. We will not be meeting a week from this Thursday.
Okay.
But our next meeting will be a week from tonight.
Right.
The
16th.
Okay. Thanks. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.